Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, and I'm John Henley. So, fasten your seatbelts, here we go. Almost exactly a year, 362 days in fact to be precise, after Britain voted to leave the European Union on June the 23rd, 2016, the Article 50 divorce talks are finally about to get underway in Brussels. Needless to say, matters have not been helped, as far as Britain's position is concerned, by the results of last week's election, which saw Theresa May unexpectedly lose her majority and try to cling on in government with the help of Northern Ireland's ultra-conservative DUP party. Now that's something that could well have an impact on the Brexit talks, as of course could the weakened position of the Prime Minister generally within her own party after a shockingly bad campaign, the emergence of a bloc of Scottish Conservative MPs who are broadly more Remain than Leave, and of course the buoyancy of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, who had a barnstorming election and is now on something of a high. Not, of course, that that means that the Labour Party's position on Brexit is any clearer, and the Tories' stance certainly isn't. We have some MPs and ministers insisting that nothing's changed, a hard Brexit outside the single market and the customs union remains the goal. Other senior figures, like the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, are pushing for a softer, jobs-first Brexit, and yet others, including former Prime Minister John Major, want a cross-party commission to hammer out a national consensus on the kind of Brexit Britain really wants. And waiting in the wings, of course, are a bunch of 70 or 80 hardliner pro-Brexit MPs who really won't give an inch, especially on immigration. In short, what's clear now is that nothing's clear. There's no particular kind of Brexit, hard or soft or anything in between, that commands a majority in the House of Commons. No one has the first idea what the plan is. And as things stand, Britain appears to be a country without a government without a Brexit strategy, and Brexit negotiators without objectives. All the while, of course, the EU27 are ready and waiting. The Brexit clock that started when the Prime Minister triggered Article 50 on March the 29th is ticking, and all things being equal, it will stop ticking on March the 29th, 2019, in 2 years' time, minus, of course, the 7 weeks we've just wasted on the election. So, joining me to try and make some kind of sense of this unholy mess are Dan Roberts, The Guardian's Brexit policy editor, and our Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin. In a slightly longer edition of Brexit Means than usual, we're going to be looking at how the Article 50 talks will work, where the main stumbling blocks may lie, and what impact Britain's domestic political mess may have on the whole process. So, Jennifer, can I start with you? I suppose the one saving grace here is that the Article 50 talks that are due to start on Monday are at least about very clearly defined issues, aren't they? So we can kind of kick the overall Brexit strategy question into the long grass, to a certain extent at least. But can we look first of all at the nuts and the bolts of the talks? Who's going to meet who, where, for how long? And also, how important will this whole issue of sequencing be? Is Europe really determined to stick to the sort of no trade talks before Article 50 progress position?
So when we come to the nuts and bolts, for the EU side, the chief negotiator is Michel Barnier. He's a former EU commissioner, former French foreign minister, very experienced and very in command of his brief, and he will be facing David Davis, the Brexit secretary, so that they will be sitting down opposite each other for the first time on Monday to open these Brexit talks with their teams beside them. And what we're expecting is that The talks will run on a cycle of 1 month, where there will be 1 week of very intensive negotiations between the British and Michel Barnier and his team, and then they will break away, and they will in the intervening weeks they will be exchanging papers. The EU will be reporting back to its member states on positions, and they will be preparing for the next round. And as for the sequencing, it's a very important point for the EU, because they've made clear right from the beginning that the talks have a certain order. First comes the divorce, and only then can you talk about a new relationship, so any new trade deal. So for the EU, that means starting with sorting out citizens' rights, which is also something the British government is very keen to finalise soon. But the EU also want to talk about the money, the Brexit bill, and resolving the question of the Irish border. Now, until recently, before the election, David Davis was promising to fight this order. He really wanted to talk about trade much sooner, and he said there would be the row of the summer about this. But in fact, it does now seem that the EU sequence might rather end up suiting the UK after all, given the disarray in its government, the fact that there is no clear strategy for Brexit, and Theresa May has no mandate now for her hard Brexit. So in the end, it could prove that the sequencing row may not even materialise.
Dan, is that what you're hearing from the London end?
It is. For once, we're hearing relatively the same message coming out of Whitehall. I think it's really telling, though, that basically before these things have already started, the UK has conceded on at least three or four quite big procedural questions. The EU has been able to determine who sits around the table. The Brits, first of all, wanted technical discussions, as Jennifer reported the other day. But actually, the Brits had to concede that they would have to bring a minister along to show they were serious. The Brits also wanted, as you said, to start with trade. They've had to concede on that. They were also reluctant to sort of pin down to having David Davis start on Monday, because it would get ahead of the Queen's speech. They've had to basically bow to that, because they didn't want to be seen to be trying to postpone things. So it really does show the balance of power here, that despite all the bluster from the British side, they've already conceded before on at least three big issues before we start.
Yeah, that is quite telling. Okay, now let's look at the issues then in turn. Jennifer, the first priority, as you said, for both sides, for the EU27 and for the British government, is citizens' rights, which is the rights under EU law of those 3.5 million EU citizens who are living in the UK and the 1.2 British nationals on the continent. Now, you know, we say this is, of course, the top priority, but that's being the top priority is not the same as you know, the two sides being able to agree on the actual resolution of these problems. And there are quite a few possible problems that may raise their heads here, aren't there? Because rights aren't just about residency, but they're about a whole raft of other stuff around education and work and social benefits and healthcare. And the UK is on the record several times now as saying it's going to make a generous offer to the EU on citizens' rights. But there are quite a few sticking points, particularly, as I understand it, around family members. You know, the fact that family members, even unborn family members of, for example, EU citizens living in the UK, would be entitled to come and join the rights holder who is already in the UK, and that can go on basically, you know, in perpetuity, and also rights around EU or non-EU spouses is a particularly delicate issue. At the moment, it's actually easier for an EU citizen living in Britain to bring a non-EU spouse to come and live with him and her in the UK than it is for a British citizen to do the same. There are all sorts of requirements that have to be met around income and that kind of stuff for British citizens. And finally, of course, there's this question of who's going to have the jurisdiction over any disputes on citizens' rights. Jennifer, where do you see the main sticking points coming on this?
Well, yes, I think you've highlighted some of the tricky issues there. And from the EU point of view, their main response to this so-called generous offer is to ask, well, where are the details? Because what the EU are really seeking are line-by-line detailed guarantees on every aspect of citizens' rights. So the ideal for the EU negotiators is that citizens can continue to live their lives as if Brexit had never happened, so they maintain the same rights to work, to pensions, to healthcare, and that you want each of these things to be guaranteed. And that also takes goes into some very tricky areas for the UK, which, as you mentioned, is the issue of spouses, where spouses coming from a non-EU country would have actually greater rights to come and live in the UK than a British person would have the right to bring a non-EU spouse into the UK, because they would have to pass a certain income test. So, for example, if you're a Spaniard living in the UK, you can bring your Argentinian husband to come and live with you. But if you're a British citizen, then that Argentinian national would have to pass an income test. So at the moment, there is an anomaly that EU citizens living in the UK actually have slightly more rights than UK nationals, and that will be a very tricky issue to resolve.
Dan, have you heard?
Well, I think that this could play very badly politically, because I think what we're drifting towards, especially if Britain softens its Brexit demands on other fronts and we end up having to take a lot of rules from Brussels in order to stay within the EU, there's a danger we will end up looking like a vassal state where British citizens have less rights than EU citizens. We have to pay money, but we don't get any say on how it's spent. We have to agree to certain rules, but we don't get to set them in any way. I mean, this... Without wanting to sound like a Brexiteer, this is in danger of feeling like sort of Imperial Rome, where Britain ends up as this sort of second-class outpost. Now, you could say that some of these things are true right now. I mean, the disparity between the spousal immigration rights exists today. But if this is codified and written down in the divorce Article 50 talks, I think it really will underline just what a sort of client state we're in danger of becoming.
And what about this question of jurisdiction, Jennifer? The EU is completely determined. Is it that the European Court of Justice should rule on any disputes over whether or not these rights have been guaranteed and being applied?
Exactly, and that is a very clear red line for the EU, and they show no sign at all of backing down on it. It's quite interesting to say that not everyone in the EU country shares this opinion. There was a very interesting opinion from a former ECJ judge recently, who no longer an ECJ judge but now retired, and he suggested that this was unfair for Britain, that why should a third country, or sort of a foreign country from the EU's point of view, be required to continue adhering to EU law, and potentially, you know, EU law could be, or the writ of the ECJ could apply in the UK for 100 years. If you think today that there are small children, babies who may one day want to go to the European Court of Justice to protect their rights, maybe to pensions much later in life. So this is it's going to be a really fraught question in the negotiations. It goes right to the heart of the sovereignty argument that's been such a big thing for the Brexiteers. And but for the EU, they show absolutely no sign of backing down. So I think this will be an early test of how well the negotiations are going to go, because if there is a compromise on this, then it will be promising that there will be compromises on other areas.
This is meant to be the easy one. Let's not forget, this is of the first three, this is the only one that anybody's got any confidence could be solved. The what happens after the first three is almost completely uncharted territory. And yet, as we've just outlined, this supposedly easy issue is fraught with political danger right from the start.
Yeah, indeed. Well, let's turn to some of the other dangers then. Having looked at citizens' rights, Dan, the other main issues for the divorce talks will be the border in Northern Ireland, or the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which will become an EU-UK land border, of course, once Britain leaves. And the budget. Now we'll come to the budget in a minute, but the exit bill, as Britain likes to call it, and the sort of the settlement, as the EU likes to call it. So, but looking at the border first, Dan, I mean it's not just about the border, is it? It contains much bigger questions about whether Britain wishes or not to stay in the customs union, and of course the whole question might be considerably complicated by the government, the Prime Minister's sort of newfound dependence on the votes of those 10 DUP MPs at Westminster. How do you see that playing out?
In short, I don't. I think this is one of those issues where I think the EU is itself living in cloud cuckoo land if it thinks that this can be discussed separately from the future trading relationship that it has with the UK. Because clearly these are issues that go away if you have some sort of customs union that looks like we've got at the moment or indeed is what we have at the moment, but are hugely fraught if the land border between Northern Ireland and the Republic is effectively the external border of the EU. The Irish Republic government will be under legal obligation to police that border, to collect tariffs, to monitor livestock and make sure that British goods flowing in are adhered to European standards. All of those things will require customs officers. Now, you can dress it up in all sorts of talk of a virtual border, one that's policed with number plate recognition and online verification and all these sorts of things. But at the end of the day, if that border, if those things are to mean anything and if they're going to withhold legal tests, they will have to be pulling over trucks and looking at them. And that will cause delays and that will create the kind of border that will give rise to sectarian tension again. And as you say, the DUP creates an extra layer of difficulty, because one way round that might have been to say, well, actually, why not make the Northern Ireland have a kind of special status so that it doesn't, so that it's semi in, semi out of the EU. And the thing is that that's an absolute red line for the DUP, who would never contemplate anything like that. The only other alternative that I've heard of from talking to people is for the Republic to have some kind of special status, for it to be somehow within the UK kind of jurisdiction, and for them, then there have to be special relationships going from the Republic to the rest of the EU. And that's an absolute non-starter in Dublin as well, because that, you know, they do most of their trade with the EU. Why should they change their relationship when we're not prepared to change ours? So these are all things that can't be untangled until we have some sense of what the future relationship looks like.
Jennifer, on that point, do you think that's recognised in Brussels and in the EU27 more broadly, that really this question may not be one that can be resolved until one quite big chunk of the future relationship is actually agreed on?
Yes, I think diplomats would admit that. And it's also worth pointing out that there is actually some flexibility worked into the EU's negotiating stance, because although they have taken this very strict divorce first, then we talk about the future approach. In fact, they've also said that if there is sufficient progress on the free areas they want to solve, then the negotiations could quite rapidly move on to talking about the future, including trade, including customs and all sorts of other things. So we could even get to that point as soon as October. I think the summit of EU leaders at the end of October could be a very important moment to assess whether the UK is making progress. And I think it's not necessary for the UK to sort of finalise every single point when it comes to, say, the border question or the bill, but to show that there's some willingness there. I think possibly on the citizens' rights issue, then they'll be looking for much more precise guarantees. But there might be some of those other issues that can be fudged and can be deemed a sufficient progress, allowing the UK to move on.
Okay. This could be an important stepping stone. I mean, I suppose, yes, to sort of be glass half full about it, one could imagine a scenario where both sides commit to having an open and soft border with Ireland, and then they go, and how are we going to get there? And then somebody says, well, we have to have some kind of customs arrangement. And you can see it becoming the beginnings of that, then that segueing into the next conversation. So perhaps some early sort of broad brush, airy-fairy declaration of goodwill
sort of
will
be enough. Agreement to disagree for the time.
Well, yes, an agreement to kind of pursue a soft border might be enough to then at least start the important conversation.
Okay. Well, let's look briefly at the third and possibly the most problematic of all of the issues that are supposed to be dealt with in the Article 50 part of the talks, namely the exit bill. Jennifer, there's some news on that this morning, is there?
Well, we hear that the European Commission is now revising down its estimate of the exit bill. This is a report in the FT of a meeting that took place this week about the bill. Although there have been estimates ranging from a sort of 60 to 100 billion, it now seems that could be scaled back somewhere between sort of more like 40 billion net for the UK to pay. Because it really depends on what you include in this bill. And the Commission actually have always taken a more conservative approach than EU member states. it was actually member states, countries such as France and Germany, that were really pressing for the UK to have to pay its share of the EU's seven-year budget. Now, that budget was negotiated by David Cameron back in 2013, and it runs for 7 years, expiring at the end of 2020, which means that if the UK leaves the EU in 2019, that's a big black hole in the EU budget. It's a problem for all the other member states. It's a problem if then they have to find farm subsidies and research funds that they'd never thought they'd have to find. So I mean, the reason why the budget is so complicated is because it ricochets right into how the EU's own interests and how they will divide the money, and that's always a source of tension. But then again, the EU does have a long experience in arguing about money and coming to solutions and being creative. So I think the budget is workable, but it depends on. Maybe it depends on a different tone from the UK. I think officials here were shocked when Theresa May suggested that the UK might not owe anything at all. So I think if the UK comes in with this line next week, then that's going to go down very badly and the talks will get off to a bad start.
Yeah. How about nothing? Yes. how about zero? What about that?
Yeah. I mean, Dan, I mean, can we expect a tone? I mean, David Davis in the past has said very volubly that these kind of amount, particularly the 100 billion amount that was being floated for a while, was an absurd and ridiculous sum, and Britain would simply leave the negotiating table if that was what was demanded. Where are we now on that?
I think paradoxically the election result may have helped this a little bit, because first of all it removes this absurd notion that Britain could just sort of walk away. Theresa May asked for a mandate for that strategy and received a resounding no. If there was one clear message from the electorate, is that they did not want her to say go in there with a gun to her head, threatening to pull the trigger. And it also gives her a get out, because one can imagine a situation, say they compromise at 20 billion, say they spread it out over 10 years, say it's 2 billion a year. It's okay, it's not a great Daily Mail headline, but in the big scheme of things, it's really not worth the Britain getting too het up about. And Theresa May can simply shrug her shoulders and say, well, look, this is the price of you not giving me my mandate. You know, I would have secured a better deal if I had the backing of the country, but
this is the best we can do.
And so it, rationally, it's not worth worrying about compared to the economic pain that's at risk if we screw this up. And politically, she now has a sort of get-out clause. I mean, it's never going to look good, but I suppose there's a little bit more hope that we might get there this week.
Okay, Jennifer, just in terms of the timing, it's the EU that have sort of given itself the authority to say, well, okay, now we have now made sufficient progress on the Article 50 issues in order to be able to start looking at the shape of the future relationship. Does the EU have a time frame in mind for when ideally that moment might come?
They think they will assess sufficient progress in October if things are going well. So we'll really have to see how the talks progress over the summer. Another moment to watch out for will actually be as soon as the end of next week, when Theresa May comes to Brussels for one of the regular EU summits. And that will be her first encounter with EU leaders since her disastrous election result. And that Brexit will certainly be discussed at that meeting, although the EU will try and make sure that it doesn't dominate, because the talks between Barnier and Davis will be going on separately. So we'll wait until October until we get a sense of whether the UK will be allowed to move forward for trade talks. It could be delayed until December, at the end of the year, if things are not going well. But EU negotiators are still hopeful that things could move quite rapidly on the first phase, and that would allow the UK to get into trade talks and all sorts of other areas, foreign policy, police cooperation.
The great irony of all this, of course, is that we were always told that things wouldn't get real until the autumn because of other European elections, particularly the German election would have to be held at first before we could get real. And I think what's quite possible now is that it may not be able to get real until the next British election is held, which will probably also be in the autumn, in my view, because none of the legislation written needs to pass to make Brexit work can be done even with the DUP formal coalition. The majority is just too slender. So at some point they're going to need to go back to the country and get a proper mandate, and that is no way going to be able to happen before the autumn. And actually, perhaps the timings are now aligned. Perhaps that suits everybody. This gets real after the autumn.
Okay, well, let's look a little bit beyond the autumn now. And I know there's a little bit kind of crystal ball gazing for obvious reasons. But let's just look at how the UK's overall Brexit strategy, what kind of a Brexit it might end up with, may have been affected by this remarkable, unexpected election result that we got. Jennifer, first, how has the fact that the government no longer has a majority, how has that gone down in Brussels? And what's the view on how the talks could be affected going forward? And also, I suppose, how much of a laughing stock is Britain in Brussels at the moment?
Well, a state of flux is the phrase that keeps cropping up again and again. I mean, people were really stunned, I think, at the election results, because I think many had assumed, as the polls did, that the opinion polls, that Theresa May would come back with a big mandate, and although nobody was jumping for joy at her hard Brexit, they knew what it was and they knew what she wanted. Whereas now that's all been thrown into confusion. And from the EU point of view, the UK simply doesn't know what it wants, and they are concerned that they will start negotiating, and then halfway through their negotiating partner will change and potentially come back with a new mandate, and that will put the talks into confusion. They will do their best to stick to their timetable and their objectives, but there's huge uncertainty and damage to the sort of UK government reputation in Europe, I think, and the sort of mocking newspaper headlines and cartoons have been widely shared here, of course, and it does give you a flavour that Theresa May is seen as a weak and a really humiliated leader who's not in a position to drive forward her vision of Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, what might happen? Just imagine for it. I mean, imagine that Dan's scenario is right, and that the UK is heading for a second election in the autumn, and suddenly then the government changes. What would be the EU's? I mean, is there scope on the EU side in that case? I mean, would they stick to the 2 year, to the sort of March 2019 deadline? Could things be extended? What might happen from the EU point of view then?
I don't see any prospect of significantly extending the 2 year deadline. Maybe if the UK is lucky, there will be a few weeks to sort of eke it out at the end. But the EU is very keen to wrap these talks up in time, mainly because they have the European Parliament elections probably May, June 2019. And for them, that is the ultimate deadline. The UK has to be out by then, otherwise things get very messy. And also, they don't want these negotiations to drag on forever. The EU wants to show that it's moving on with other projects, with defence, with Eurozone reform. It doesn't want to be talking about this sort of UK Brexit psychodrama for years and years. But added to that, I think it's worth pointing out that there are only so many models that exist for the UK to interact with the EU. So that could be a Norway-style single market model. It could be something more distant, like a trade agreement based on a Canada model or a Ukraine model. These are some of the ideas being bandied about. But there aren't an infinite number of models. So I think even if there was a new government in the autumn, yes, that could cause a temporary delay in the talks. But ultimately, there are only so many options for the UK, and they will have to choose something.
I mean, if push comes to shove, Dan, I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Do you think if this confusion on the UK side persists, might it be worth the EU simply coming to Britain and saying, OK, well, here are your four or five possible outcomes. Which one are you going to go for?
Presenting a menu, yeah, rather than a la carte. Yes, I think that perhaps that might sort of help concentrate minds a little bit here. I'm also in a state of flux on this. I began the week feeling relatively upbeat about the prospect for some movement towards a softer Brexit. We saw an outbreak of common sense from some of the grown-ups in the Tory party, lots of grandees coming forward and demanding that business interests are taken more closely into account. Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, most significantly. The big problem, though, is the more you start, once you concede that less Brexit is better than more Brexit, you start to say, well, how about no Brexit? I mean, many of these models collapse down when you start looking at them. So, for example, the Norway model, whilst I think is a much better option than what we're proposing at the moment and would allow us to remain members of the single market at possibly tolerable political cost, and certainly allow us to maintain the illusion of having sort of adhered to the referendum result. At the end of the day, it looks like a much shabbier version of what we have. It's basically sort of EU membership light. EU membership light makes it sound like a sort of, you know, nice diet thing, but it's a kind of poor man's EU membership. And I think that the trouble right now is you have a bunch of, you know, diehards clinging to this notion of 100% Brexit. And the minute they concede an inch, the whole thing starts to unravel. And so I think Jennifer's term psychodrama is probably the best way of thinking about this. This is really about talking some people down from the ledge. And I'm still not completely convinced that we can do that without some sort of change of government. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
It is quite a big... I mean, it's a lot to ask of a politician to fundamentally change their mind on something they've campaigned for some cases for sort of 20 years.
Although in Theresa May's case, about 20 minutes. I mean, don't forget she was a Remainer through the referendum. I mean, that's the other cause for hope here is that the vast majority of the government, the cabinet still, possibly a majority of backbench MPs, I don't know, maybe 50-50, are still Remainers, you know, or were Remainers before the referendum. And probably the same sort of split on the Labour side. It's the leadership that is the issue. And the Labour leadership is also an issue here because they sense a bigger prize. For them, Brexit is a sort of a sideshow to their idea of political revolution.
Well, let's just lastly look at Labour briefly. It's precisely their ambiguity on the whole question, of their sort of deliberate ambiguity on the question of Brexit, that may have helped them in the election, is it not?
Yes, and I think they would be... they will be thinking it's foolhardy to mess with that. It's a winning formula to fudge Brexit because it allowed them to basically shift the election onto other grounds, ones that they were stronger on, and to allow the protest vote to sort of play out against Theresa May. And you can see why, if their aim is to get Jeremy Corbyn into number 10, it may make sense to continue to do that. And there may be many reasons why Jeremy Corbyn at number 10 will make good sense for all sorts of other reasons. The difficulty is that a prime minister's last for 5 years, Brexit's for life. And there is an opportunity right now to force some common sense onto the government, were the opposition to be minded to do so. And I fear they won't.
OK, Jennifer, anything to add to that? This idea of a sort of a menu of options that Brussels might present, is that a runner?
I think I think there are only a limited number of options, but really it will be for the UK to decide what it really wants. I think the Brussels will wait for the UK to say, we want this kind of Brexit, and then they will work out how to go about delivering that. But I think for EU diplomats here, the big question for them is Theresa May or whoever succeeds her, if there is another election, is that person still going to be driven by the interests of the Conservative Party, by holding the Conservative Party together? Because the sense that people have in Brussels is that this whole question from David Cameron onwards has been about internal Tory party unity, and they felt that even Theresa May was prioritising that rather than thinking about what kind of Brexit she really wanted and what was even best for the country. So I think... I mean, that's the ultimate question for them. You know, is the government going to decide what it wants, or is it still going to be in the grip of the sort of Brexit fever and the very hard Brexit line of the Tory party?
I'd love to see them do that. I mean, it's a very provocative thing to do, but as an EU citizen, I would like my EU leaders to ask David Davis when he turns up on Monday, just what is your authority? Who do you think you are? Mm. You don't form a government. You don't have a majority in Parliament. How dare you come here and profess to talk for a country that's deeply divided on issues, where lots of our citizens are, you know, violently opposed to what you're suggesting? Come back when you have a mandate, please, Mr. Davis. That's what I'd like to see them say.
That would certainly put the cat among the pigeons. Yeah. All right. Well, I think probably that's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Jennifer in Brussels, Jennifer Rankin, Dan Roberts here in the studio for joining us. In the meantime, please subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. It's certainly going to be an interesting few weeks, months and years to come. If you want to get in touch with us about Brexit stuff, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. If you'd like to review the pod and be in with a chance of featuring in our podcast weekly column, then the email for that is podcasts@theguardian.com. Till next time then, I'm John Henley. The producer is Carrie Stewart. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.